This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
So we'll start with the SAG nominations, because as we record this, they have just come out. The first big rush of thrilling names for me to type into our CMS and, you know, try to process everything that's going on as we look at it. And I do think there were a solid number of big surprises, which is funny to say because it's early in the season and technically everything is a surprise. But I certainly wasn't expecting to be cheering for Bradley Cooper with, you know, axes or baseball bats in my hand or whatever he has in that last scene in Licorice Pizza. So that I would start with that as my personal most delightful surprise of the nominations. But maybe let's go around. Richard, what delighted and surprised you in these SAG nominations?
I'm really glad they recognized Ben Affleck for what I think is a good performance in The Tender Bar. I would have nominated him for The Last Duel instead of The Tender Bar. But I think he's good. And I know that his personal life has been rocky and he's said some things that people have been upset about. But like, distilled down to the work, he was a great performer in 2021. And also, I think hopefully this is a little like concessionary nod to The Way Back, which premiered like, or came out like a week before COVID shutdowns in 2020. Yeah. So that movie just kind of disappeared into the ether, which was a shame because it was a very personal story and in some ways. So yeah, I think it's nice that, you know, the actors are recognizing their fellow actor.
It was kind of feeling like The Tender Bar was also disappearing into the ether. Like, it's on Amazon. It's available for everyone to watch. Every time I turn on my Apple TV, it tells me to watch it. But it's had really mysterious buzz up to this point. But yesterday, or a couple days ago, he was on the cover of Entertainment Weekly for their awards issue. So I guess that was a sign that it had more buzz than we thought.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a solid movie. It's not, it's you know, it's a memoir adaptation and kind of has this traditional kind of frustrating structure of that, where it's just very episodic and we don't really feel an arc, you know, over the course of the film. But the acting is great, and Affleck is definitely the standout there.
David, what delighted you from these nominations?
I'll go to supporting actress Ruth Negga, making it through for Passing. It was a really nice surprise. SAG can lean toward the more broadly accessible, let's say. And I think
we'll get there, I guess.
And I think, you know, Ruth Negga, to me, that's an undeniable performance in Passing, but it's one that had been a little frustratingly outside of the conversation. And she's really had a great couple weeks. She won National Society of Film Critics Best Supporting Actress Prize, and she made this field among many other much bigger contenders, most of whom are in strong Best Picture candidates, which I think bodes really, really well for her Oscar chances. So I was thrilled to see that.
Yeah, and you think about how her nomination for Loving, I don't know what the exact trajectory is. You might remember it better than me, David, but like, no one knew she had the buzz, and all of a sudden she popped up there at the Oscars, and that seems very possible for Passing again.
Yeah, she's pulling it again.
All right, how about you, Rebecca? What thrilled you?
I was really excited to see Coda on the ensemble list. I think that film has basically been on the awards path for a year now because it came out at Sundance. And, you know, for a while I felt like it was kind of getting lost. And now it's really been picking up quite a few nominations and other sort of critics' prizes. So to see it, you know, be appreciated by the actors as well, I thought was really exciting.
Yeah, my big swing in our nominations was predicting Emilia Jones in the actress category, which didn't happen. Troy Kotsur did get in as supporting actor, but I think it was a similar idea of like actors should. I mean, everyone I think loves this movie when they do see it, and you can imagine actors really responding to it. And it's an ensemble that works in unison together. Maybe unlike some of the other ensembles that got nominated today.
Yeah.
Okay, what are we mad about or shocked by? You can pick either one. I mean, I think I know what the biggest snub is. Who wants to say it?
Well, yeah, they've deposed Princess Diana. Well, I don't know what the term, what the royal term would be, but
beheaded, I think, is beheaded what that Princess is. Diana.
Kristen Stewart did not get in, whereas Jessica Chastain did,
and Jennifer Hudson.
Yes, mm-hmm. I very cynically wonder with the Chastain of it all. If maybe publicly going to bat for a fellow actor after a nasty, scurrilous New Yorker profile somehow raises your estimation in other actors' eyes? I don't know, but Chastain
Jeremy
was definitely
Strong
out.
Did get nominated.
Yeah, Chastain was definitely out there like defending her fellow actors in the last couple weeks, so maybe that had some effect. Or maybe they just liked the performance in Eyes of Tammy Faye, which they would not be wrong about. I think she's good in that movie. It's just surprising that she's there, and Kristen Stewart, who since Labor Day, or since pre-Labor Day at the Venice Film Festival, has been viewed as something of a front runner for Spencer.
Mm. Yeah, what do we think is the reason for it?
I don't know what else she could have done, to be honest, because she's been doing so much press and really putting herself out there. So it to me, it feels like a, you know, problem with the film just not, you know, it was very polarizing and we knew that it was going to be that way, but it did seem like people agreed her performance was worthy of attention. But I think maybe it's just because the film is not being, you know, welcomed or appreciated.
Yeah, I flashed back to early September coming out of the Telluride premiere and a high level publicist saying to me, well, I hated that. the movie also really underperformed on the BAFTA long list today, which we can talk a little bit more about, which tend to be pretty predictive of the sort of, you know, overall state of the race. And I do worry for her. I think that the movie just did not click with the industry at all. And she may still overcome that, but I don't think this is a case of like, oh, well, she missed here, but, you know, she's fine to get into the Oscars. I would still bet on that, but I do think she's in some trouble.
Yeah, and I think we've all kind of had a hunch that as a front runner, like her status has diminished a little bit, and Nicole Kidman was maybe surging, and Nicole Kidman, I mean, I don't think anyone thought she wouldn't get nominated by SAGs, but that did feel like a very symbolic way to say like, oh, well, okay, that Kidman is probably your new front runner if you had to pick one.
I don't know who's winning that category. It's interesting that Chastain, I mean, she has popped up everywhere. She got the Globe nomination, the Critics' Choice nomination. She made the BAFTA list today. It feels like the kind of big performance that will score some votes. But I honestly, yeah, I mean, I feel like you'd have to default at this point to Kidman. Or honestly, Olivia Colman is not one to count out. That's another, you know, if you look at The Lost Daughter and Spencer side by side, I think they're two movies that are going to alienate a good portion of their audience. And so to me, it's interesting that Colman was able to break through, even though that movie is smaller, had less time, it came out later, and she still made it through. So I'm looking at her too. I have no idea.
Olivia Colman winning and then thanking Lady Gaga again at the end of her speech would be phenomenal.
Can only dream.
Well, speaking of Lady Gaga, should we talk about House of Gucci? You know, her and Jared Leto getting nominated isn't a huge shock, but the ensemble nomination on top of that, David, you pointed out that it tied The Power of the Dog, which didn't get an ensemble nomination, but got three individual ones. House of Gucci and Power of the Dog would not have been the pair of frontrunners at SAGs, I would have expected, I guess I'll say that. What do we make of this?
House of Gucci made money. Like, I don't know, does that help?
It can't hurt.
It has a lot of big famous people in it. Who are doing a lot of acting, whether or not that is to the liking of everyone, has certainly been up for debate since the movie came out. But I don't know. If I were someone in SAG, I might say, hey, like, here's a way to support a it's MGM, so it's kind of half a studio at this point, but, like, you know, some sort of studio adjacent thing, putting a mid-budget movie with lots of stars that isn't about, you know, superheroes, like, I would feel encouraging of that, especially my fellow actors who really put themselves on the line by doing wild Italian-ish accents.
And I do think it is an ensemble film. Like, they may all be acting in different movies, but they're acting opposite each other. So, you know, it does sort of have that fun ensemble feel to it. So I could see people, you know, giving it attention for that. But yeah, and I don't know. I don't know what else to say about that.
This they always nominate at least one movie that is not much of a Best Picture, even nomination contender.
Sure.
And I had my eyes on The Harder They Fall as the one that would be that. Just given, again, really big, fun ensemble cast on Netflix, and which, you know, more eyeballs always helps. But House of Gucci got a lot of eyeballs. So I don't think it's too shocking in retrospect, because it does fit what they like to do and what they tend to gravitate toward. But yeah, I think the bigger surprise is that they spread the wealth so much, where most of the ensemble nominees, like, it was, you did not get a second individual acting nomination if you got into the ensemble category. Like, Anjanou Ellis was not nominated for King Richard, and Marley Matlin was not nominated for Coda, and the Belfast guys were not nominated, while Katrina Balfe was, and on and on. But House of Gucci transcended that that trend. It was the one film that bucked that trend. So I don't know what to make of that. But, you know, in isolation, it doing well at SAG, I don't think is a huge surprise or necessarily means much for its Oscar chances, beyond the fact that, you know, Lady Gaga is a strong Best Actress contender, and Jared Leto is on that supporting actor bubble.
Yeah. What do we make of Don't Look Up being an ensemble nomination with no individual nominees?
Yeah.
Not surprising, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I think we had spoken about it last week as a potential winner because, again, it's very star-studded. It's easily watched. It's kind of almost designed to be watched at home versus, you know, some movies that may have suffered. I think Spencer, for example, that's probably not good on a screener. You know, so I, Don't Look Up is, I thought that maybe we'd see some individual breakout nominees from Don't Look Up, but I guess, like you were saying, David, that oftentimes if they get the ensemble, they don't get other things.
I had picked Leo to possibly get an individual nom on our sort of SAG predictions list, and I went back and forth on it, and I was incorrect, but I do agree it's just one of those, like, big, beautiful ensembles. And shout out to Ariana Grande and Kid Cudi for getting their their SAG noms as part of the ensembles, because that has the biggest list of names that actually get to be a part of the ensemble nom.
I'm just relieved Timothée Chalamet did not go 0-3. That would have been pretty brutal. But,
one of his
casts got in. Dune and French Dispatch did not, but, you know.
He's got plenty to be proud of.
He's got plenty to be proud of. But yeah, I was really surprised Leo didn't make it in, actually. I mean, you have to figure Javier Bardem took his spot, and they didn't nominate Ricardo's for ensemble. Yeah, it's a weird one to me.
Yeah, Javier Bardem was a surprise for me, too. And it did seem like if he was going to get in there, that it would have gotten him for ensemble. But I think you were pointing out that the ensemble options for Ricardo is like just four people. Which is kind of a shame for that movie.
That's true.
Well, so also in Don't Look Up, but not nominated for it, Cate Blanchett getting it for Nightmare Alley surprised me. We've been gone back and forth on that movie as a maybe Best Picture contender because it's got all these, like, really beautiful crafts in it. But the acting part of the equation has always felt a little funny. I don't know that I would still count on her for an Oscar nomination, but it's a sign that somebody's really got some affection for that movie, right?
I wonder if she is in a similar situation to Ben Affleck. On the BAFTA lists, Blanchett was mentioned for Don't Look Up, but not for Nightmare Alley. But I think there may be a growing consensus that she's had an interesting year with two very, very big, different performances in those two movies. I don't know if this means that the Nightmare Alley lane is the way to go, because that movie otherwise seemed to really be fading. Like, it was snubbed by the Makeup and Hairstyling Guild. It didn't make some key Oscar shortlists. So I was kind of counting her out entirely for that movie. But again, SAG just SAG went their own way in pretty much every way.
I think the thing to keep in mind for people listening who don't remember is that every time Emily Blunt turns to her mantle and sees her SAG award, she remembers that Regina King was not nominated that year and then went on to win the Oscar. So the SAG sometimes does weird things that are not predictive of the Oscars. And I feel like Blanchett might be in that sort of Emily Blunt zone in a way where, like, I don't know that this will repeat at the Oscars, but it could. Whereas Ruth Negga, who, you know, is kind of like, will she get in? It's one of those weird things where it's like, if she gets in, I feel like she could win, you know. You know, people have clearly watched that movie, and she's wonderful in it. So we'll see. But I think it's a really exciting thing for Negga, because I that means she has momentum. Whereas weirdly, I don't feel like this means that Blanchett has momentum.
Totally.
I don't know how I'm squaring that in my head, but
no, I completely agree with that.
Well, I'm also looking at Ariana DeBose on that list, and she's the only nominee for West Side Story, which I guess isn't a huge shock, although it felt like it would have been a good ensemble contender to me. But she won the Golden Globe, which we can talk about in a minute. And I would hope that she would win here. Like, I think if she wins SAG, then, like, that is a pretty concrete narrative. Like, we've been pretty high on her as a potential winner here. But the weirdness of this list of nominees makes me just truly wonder what might happen.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let's jump over to the TV side of SAG for a second, since that is also really fascinating. It's always a weird combination of Emmy winners from last year and then new shows. As we predicted, Squid Game made a big leap, not just in the ensemble category, but for individual acting nominations. Anything else stand out to you guys about the TV SAG nominations?
Murray Bartlett. I think that's great.
Last week's guest on this very podcast. We did it. Yeah. We got him to that nomination.
He's this journeyman Australian actor who's been at it for a long time. He was on Looking. He was on an episode of Sex and the City. He's just been sort of around for the better part of, I think, 20 years, probably longer. And so it's really nice that in a show, The White Lotus, with tons of great performances, that his was singled out, as was Jennifer Coolidge's, I think, quite justly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also highlighting the madness of not having an ensemble limited series category.
It's so crazy. Like what is there to lose by just adding another category for the types of shows most people watch these days anyway?
Truly.
Also combining supporting and lead for television, but not film, is just so confusing to me. I don't understand why not have supporting actor categories for television, especially when you're looking at something like Succession, you know, which just has so many incredible performances and you can't throw them all into the actor category. So, yeah, strange. I think my biggest surprise was Morning Show did really well, and I had sort of dismissed it because of the reactions to the second season. But
yeah. How about Yellowstone getting in on the drama thing? I mean, it's the most watched show on television, so I shouldn't be shocked that it's in there. But it's really never gotten any awards attention that I can think of. So is this the beginning of the Yellowstone year?
Maybe.
Who knows?
I feel like the narrative has also developed that the drama categories are just a little bit thinner these days, because so much of that kind of television is now happening in the limited space. So it feels like it has a clear lane to break out there. I noticed when she was announcing the nominations that was like the one show Rosario Dawson really highlighted as one that she liked. And it feels like this is the year it's picked up a lot of steam in the industry. I mean, I have a lot of family members who do not live in Los Angeles who watch the show.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of started to drift to the coast a little bit more. I have not personally seen it, but it does feel like it's having a moment. So I would expect that to continue.
Side note, though, that Rosario Dawson and Vanessa Hudgens were really good
that.
Instagram Live is a terrible format for doing these nominations, because every it's not done twice, and every year there's some technical difficulty. But once they got started, they did a great job. So kudos to them.
I love that Vanessa Hudgens is having like a good
Great good year. Little
late 2021, early 2022.
Yeah, I am very excited to see what happens to her at this point. Like, I think Tick, Tick, Boom is this really nice platform for her and her talents. And I don't know what the ideal next role is for her, but I'm excited.
Yeah, and Tick, Tick, Boom, like, kind of, you know, frames her as this, like, reliable company player, you know, which is nice. I think that she's earned that.
Yeah, and as Rebecca and I have talked about, her hair in that movie is just it's phenomenal. Like, whatever she can do with that hair, I want to see it.
Where is the hair and makeup award for her hair?
we were watching that at home over the holidays, and my sister, when she walks in with the hair and the boots and the slouchy sweater and everything, my sister was like, well, that's an outfit, like very, like, admiringly.
Yeah.
she does look great in it.
Well, let's talk about the Golden Globes. David, you wrote about them for us on Monday. Not so much going over the winners, but what you called the brazen chaos of these Golden Globes, which really lived up to, I think, our wildest predictions of what a Twitter-only Golden Globes could be. Do you want to just sum up why they felt so crazy for a series of tweets, why they captured so much chaos?
I think that there was some hope-dicting about, or what I perceived as that, about how strange and out of touch and I don't even know how to describe it, these tweets could get. But the Golden Globes had decided to restrict their winner announcements publicly to Twitter while they did a private ceremony at the Beverly Hilton that wasn't live streamed. And immediately, the decision of how to announce the winners on Twitter proved absolutely bananas and and confounding. It felt like they had someone, whether it was an intern or I pray to God, but not someone who was higher up, who should have known a lot better, but people who didn't really know who the winners were as they were announcing them. And so it led to these really awkwardly written tweets that sometimes didn't feel like they were written in proper English, and at other times were bizarrely fixated on category as opposed to, like, not even naming the project that was won for. And it was nice because we've had all these cancellations, as we've talked about, and I think there's been a solemn cloud over January award season with all of us back at home, back to watching these things on our laptops. And there was a real collective glee over what the next tweet would be. And how it would be phrased. Like, I wanted to know who would win. It's the Golden Globes. It doesn't count for nothing. But I, more importantly, wanted to know how they would win. I wanted to know how, after Ariana DeBose won for West Side Story, which began in the announcement with the lyrics to Lean On Me.
Yep.
It required a lot of digging to understand that I think they were trying to reference it being a supporting performance. But there was a lot of confusion over that. And after that, there was a real nail-bitey aspect to how the next category would go.
This is maybe a long runway to take you guys down. But do you remember the movie Orphan, where Vera Farmiga adopts a child? Mm-hmm. And then it turns out to be a grown-up Estonian person who's pretending to be a child. I feel like the Golden Globes hired, like, a young, hip social media manager. And then throughout the night, they were like, wait, this is a 70-year-old from Lithuania who's just pretending. Like, the Lean On Me thing was funny, as was the, you know, laughter is the best medicine. Congratulations to West Side Story. Yeah, what was going on there? But it was a nice simulation of the usual chaos of the Globes.
Yes, absolutely.
In a weirder internet-y way. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like watching the annual speech from the HFPA president, where you're just like, who is this? Has this person ever been in front of a camera in their life? And it was but the Twitter version of it.
Yeah.
Do we make anything of the winners? I think we kind of couldn't help ourselves being like, oh, wow, Ariana DeBose, she's got some momentum now, even though, as we all know, the Globes are kind of silly and meaningless without an award show. Or are they? Do we feel like these had an impact in terms of who actually won?
I think we don't know, but I do think there's probably a little bit of a boost because the season is starved for any sort of event at this point because everything's been postponed or canceled. And I do think most of their choices were pretty reasonable and could be potential Oscar winners for a lot of them. You know, they picked Power of the Dog and West Side Story and Drive My Car for Foreign Language. So I think it does make a little bit of an impact. What I did think about a lot that day was the speeches we're missing out on, because that's really what used to give people, you know, especially acting nominees a boost was if they gave a killer speech during the Globes, it helped them for their, you know, Oscar chances. So seeing a speech by Ariana DeBose or some of these winners would have been, I think, the bigger boost. And that's what really got lost.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and the fact is they got three of last year's four Oscar acting winners wrong last, you know, they got Daniel Kaluuya right, but they missed supporting actress and both lead actors. So chances are they do better. I think you could put good money on still Will Smith and Ariana DeBose.
Nicole Kidman.
And yeah, Nicole Kidman is now sort of in that zone. And even Cody Smith McPhee for supporting actor, especially after this morning's very chaotic nominations for the SAG Awards, you have to think he's a really strong contender there. So I think they did fine in sort of rubber stamping who has a good chance at winning an Oscar. I don't know that they have any impact without, as Rebecca was saying, speeches or much promotion. Nicole Kidman did quickly thank the HFPA, which I thought was interesting, unlike most of the winners. The West Side Story folks, kind of in line with how Disney's been promoting the Globes this whole season, did acknowledge their wins, but because Rachel Zegler also won. I'm not sure that it's an impact question so much as these are very plausible winners across the board.
Yeah.
Rebecca, you mentioned Drive My Car, which, you know, also won like four awards at the National Society of Film Critics, which I was voting on last Saturday. And that coupled with its win at the Golden Globes, I feel like that's something to hang on, you know, that movie has momentum and people are now sort of saying, could it get a Best Picture nomination? Because it keeps winning. It won the top, you know, it won Best Picture at three of the top critics groups, LA, New York, and National. And I don't know, I hope that would be a really interesting narrative to see emerge, that this 3-hour Japanese film about Chekhov is in that conversation, but we don't have much other conversation to cling to. So maybe the Globes are helping, you know, guide that in some way.
Well, anecdotally, I was doing a interview with Peter Dinklage yesterday, and he was going on and on about how Drive My Car was his favorite film of like the past 5 years. So I do think if we were in those rooms with people, it would be the film that a lot of people are just adoring.
Man, speaking about films that speak directly to actors, like what could appeal more to an actor, especially someone who's done theater, than Drive My Car?
Yeah.
Also, credit where it's due to the Golden Globes. We've talked about this before, where sometimes they just get things remarkably right. They're kind of the only major award won by the Underground Railroad, which got weirdly snubbed by the Emmys last year. So seeing that win made me like, okay, well, we're grateful that they're there, for better or for worse. They picked a really good winner there.
Yeah, and MJ Rodriguez, I just wish that like she had gotten to give a speech and have her TV moment. And, you know, context of the Globes aside, like I did find myself looking at the winners on Sunday, well, or trying to kind of hieroglyphically interpret from what the tweets were telling me, like who won. I found myself wishing that they had all kind of had their show, you know, that would have been nice.
David, you mentioned the BAFTA long list earlier, which got announced the same morning as the SAG Awards. It is a long list, so it's a long list of titles, not all of which will get BAFTA nominations. But as I think you pointed out, the BAFTAs do tend to be very predictive of the Oscars. So what stood out to you from these?
Yeah, so last year, every actor who was nominated for an Oscar made the BAFTA long list except for Andra Day, and that was mainly because the United States versus Billie Holiday hadn't screened enough for those members yet. So if you're not on this list, chances of getting a nomination are pretty low. That also provides some mixed messages for folks like Ben Affleck, who were nominated for SAG Awards today but did not make the long list. It's a lot of the front runners. It's pretty much what you'd expect. There are some notable underperformances of movies like Nightmare Alley, which really didn't show up anywhere except for a few technical categories, and these are like, again, out of 20 films, and you would think that movie would be in the top five for some of those technical categories. So that was one that really stood out to me, just in line with what we've seen in terms of how the film's been performing otherwise for the last few weeks. And also Spencer. I saw these just before the SAG nominations came out, and Spencer is technically a British film, and they tend to, you know, understandably lean a little bit more in those directions, and it didn't make the top 15 for best film. Pablo Larraín did not make the director list of 20. And those are little signs that the movie is just not resonating. So even though Kristen Stewart made that list of 15 for lead actress, that coupled with her missing SAG is why I'm genuinely concerned that she will not be nominated for an Oscar because the movie is clearly not hitting in a pretty significant way. And I think that now that enough, you know, other contenders and lead actress have emerged, it's tricky. And then, you know, some of the other SAG nominations that we saw, like Bradley Cooper did double up here. So some narratives confirmed, some challenged, but it's always good to look at because the list does give you a really good indication of who the Oscar contenders are coming down to.
Yeah. Also on the actress topic, I noticed that Penelope Cruz didn't make the actress list at BAFTA, which is a real bummer.
She did not have a good day. And Parallel Mothers did make screenplay and international film. So the fact that it did not land Penelope Cruz in that top 15 for actress is a pretty bad sign for her Oscar chances, unfortunately.
Boo.
If people don't know who are listening, so basically this, now these long lists will get winnowed down to nominees by like a specially appointed jury, basically, which was sort of put in place, was it last year was the first time they did it, to kind of help diversify the nominations and think a little bit more critically. So they have a lot of critics on board, which leads me to think that like certain critically beloved, if maybe little seen films, could get in and get a nomination. So my question to all of you is, should it get a nomination? Which venerable British actor do you want to hear say Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn?
Oh, man.
We get David Attenborough to do it.
Yeah. I want, exactly. That's perfect. Yeah.
I would love someone like Juliet Stevenson.
There's just so many choices.
That is a great point, though, because, and I think they tweaked it a little bit again this year where these long lists are determined by the whole membership for the most part. So, you know, they do reflect broadly how Academy voters are thinking because there's a lot of overlap. But the top two of these long lists automatically go on to nominations now in most of these categories. So the jury...
But we can't tell what the top two is from
and
these
we can't,
lists,
right? So yeah, let's say Kitrin of Alf is in the top two for Belfast. And let's say the jury was not a fan of Belfast. That would not matter. She would still be nominated.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. However, to Richard's point, the majority of the nominees will be determined from these lists by a much smaller jury than the overall BAFTA membership or the overall acting chapter of BAFTA. So that always leads to a kind of bizarre, fascinating assortment of nominations. I think it last year it made for one of the more intriguing lists, and a lot of contenders that weren't really in the conversation otherwise got a chance to have a nice awards moment. So that's always something. That's something that I like about this new system, even though it's less good for prognostication, let's say.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the director list and imagining like the critic voted lineup where it's Drive My Car, First Cow, Petite Maman, The Souvenir Part Two, Titan. Like that's the like wild ass critic beloved director lineup. So you never know. I love seeing First Cow getting any award recognition, even, you know, a year and a half after it happened in America.
So that's for this year. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? The pandemic made so many releases very strange.
I'm now looking at the directing lineup for last year, and it was Chloe Zhao, Thomas Vinterberg, and then, I'm going to butcher the name, unfortunately, Jasmila Jovanic for Quo Vadis Aida, which
See?
Was...
See?
Sarah Gavron for Rocks, Shannon Murphy for Baby Teeth, and Lee Isaac Chung for Minari. So you had three Oscar nominees and three far from Oscar nominees.
Adding variety into award season is something I think we can all get behind, especially when Definitely. It's people that we like. So the BAFTA nominations are out on February 3rd, which I believe is a week before Oscar nominations, just about a week. So until then, we have a pretty quiet awards period ahead of us, which is a bummer, as we talked about with all these cancellations. But we'll have a lot to look forward to once February starts. And speaking of things to look forward to, we don't have much information, but we do know that there will be an Oscar host this year, as they confirmed. I think it was it TCA? It was some very strange platform for confirming that there will
TCA,
be an Oscar
I believe.
Host. I am firmly pro-Oscar host. I tweeted my pick, which would be John Waters, which I don't know if that would ever actually happen. But do we generally agree that after last year's kind of making the best with what they had, circumstances that having a proper host this year is a good move?
Yes.
Yeah. I think they should do as traditional an Oscar ceremony as possible.
Absolutely. You know?
Yeah. Just not make people feel like everything's different now. Everything changed. The world can never return to what it once was. Just give us the same. I want it to be 4.5 hours long. I want every single montage that man has ever dreamt up. Like, I want everything.
How I want much Debbie Allen dancing? Back to, yes, and Debbie Allen. Yeah,
I want all of it. My friend Ben Lee, who's a culture editor at The Guardian, pointed out to me that recently in, I think it was either one or two interviews, Tom Holland said he would love to host the Oscars.
Yes,
and then
he
apparently
did.
The Academy reached out to him, and there had been talks. So maybe it's Tom Holland because he can sing, he can dance, he's charming, he's in the biggest movie like ever practically at the moment. So that's, I mean, I wouldn't like to see that. I would prefer a sort of traditional,
Hugh Jackman style.
Like comedian. Yeah, like I want a comedian, but that would be a choice. They would get younger viewers in, maybe.
Somebody tweeted that they wanted Tom Holland and Zendaya to do it together. And now I cannot get that idea out of my head. I just think it would be wonderful. And I don't know who I have to pay to make that happen. But
I saw someone compare that idea to like James Franco and Anne Hathaway, the most recent like youth pandering example. But like their energies were so mismatched. And Tom Holland and Zendaya, like we know that their energies are well matched. Yep. We've seen it. I also think that's a great idea.
I think it's a great idea. And I think more eyeballs for the Oscars, the better, the more necessary. And I think that would achieve that. So I think it's a good idea if they can make it happen.
My other idea, which does not appeal to the youth at all, but get Steve Martin and Martin Short to do it together. Or get Selena Gomez with them.
You have
the full
Selena
Only
Gomez,
Murders crew. Yeah,
I'm all for that.
Steve Martin, I always loved as an Oscar host. And I think he would be great at it.
And it's weird that Martin Short has never done it because he would be
I
great.
Know. Mm-hmm. I feel like he must have at least done some kind of like sketch or like shown up as a presenter in a weird costume or that feels inevitable. Oscar nerds listening, please remind us when Martin Short has shown up at the Oscars before. So before we end this portion of the show and get to the interview, we did want to pause a minute to talk about Sidney Poitier, who died last week at the age of 94. He is a huge figure in Oscar history as the first Black actor to win the Best Actor Oscar. And as written about in a piece in the Awards Insider issue, out now with Katrina Balf on the cover, the story written by Rebecca Ford. But Chris Murphy wrote about the moment 20 years ago when Halle Berry and Denzel Washington both won their competitive Oscars and Sidney Poitier had won his honorary award and Denzel Washington in his speech said something to the effect of like, Sidney, I'll always be following in your footsteps. And I had just realized, reading his obits and thinking about his legacy, that I had never seen Lilies of the Field, the movie that he won Best Actor for. It came out in 1963. It's not the most famous of his movies. I don't think it's the one that people turn to first. They talk about To Start With Love and In the Heat of the Night. And it's on YouTube. So I watched it and I was really glad that I did. And David and Rebecca, was this your first encounter with it? Did you have another Sidney Poitier movie you turned to when you learned about his death?
This was my first time seeing it. Thank you for the assignment, Katie. I felt I felt like it was such a wonderful sort of palate cleanser because I've been watching a lot of kind of dark, hard TV right now, sort of preparing for Emmy season. And it's just such a wonderful film and such a captivating, charming performance by him. And I just really enjoyed it. So I'm really glad I saw it. And I thought this was a beautiful way to kind of remember him.
Yeah, I was nervous about it because, I think a lot of his legacy is tied up in how he was this groundbreaker. He was the one Black actor and a lot of his roles he's famous for, including In the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, is being like the nice, smart Black person who teaches white people the error of their ways and how to respect people. And Lilies of the Field has little elements of that, but it's way more interesting than that because he's with these Austrian nuns who have come across from East Berlin and they're trying to like scrap out this existence. And they do kind of like force him to stay with them, which was an element as the movie started. I was like, I couldn't really get comfortable with. But then the relationship that emerges from that, not just with them, but also the people in this kind of border town in Arizona, there's just so much more dynamic to it. I underestimated it at first and then was really glad I stuck with it.
Yeah, me too. I didn't know anything about the movie, really. I had just read Wesley Morris's amazing essay, remembering him, and the thesis of it was essentially he was the movie star we needed him to be, and that he pulled off this kind of impossible balance of being what you were saying, Katie, the one in so many movies and representing so much, but also being a pretty dynamic, interesting actor in his own right and finding nuance in those roles. And I'd seen him, of course, in his other, I would say it's safe to say, more famous movies, but never in this one. And I really was taken with him in this. And like you said, the dynamics are really interesting, and it's a subtler movie than I thought it would be. And yeah, it was really interesting to see it right after I'd read the essay, because it showed me a whole new side of him that I didn't know about. I felt kind of shameful about it, because I do care about Oscar's history, and I care about his milestone, but I didn't see this whole other side to him as an artist and as a groundbreaker.
Yeah. Yeah. I was revisiting In the Heat of the Night as well, which also starts with him like trying to leave a town and other people convincing him to stick around against his will, which is a weird synchronicity. And obviously his performance is really powerful and really famous. And, you know, the scene where he slaps the owner of the cotton farm. But in Lilies of the Field is lighter, and he's funny in it, and he gets these kind of like goofy scenes of teaching these nuns English, and he's like, it is so physical, and he's smiling a lot, and then he like befriends some of the, you know, other people who are helping him build the chapel. And like you were saying, David, it's just this whole other element, and you knew how talented he was and that he had this ability, but I didn't realize how good of a showcase Lilies of the Field was for all of those aspects of his personality.
Yeah.
So Lilies of the Field, it's on YouTube to watch for free. I don't know what the right situation is, but it was a very good transfer of this black and white movie from 1963. And it's 90 minutes long. So if, like Rebecca, you're watching, 8 hours of dark, violent television, which I have too. I was watching Yellow Jackets and then paused it to watch Lilies of the Field. it's worth your time in every sense of the word.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So we'll end the show with my conversation with Jamie Dornan, who is part of the SAG-nominated ensemble of Belfast. He plays Pa, the father figure in this movie, very heavily based on Kenneth Branagh's childhood. He's gotten all kinds of attention for this role and plays a really essential role in the ensemble, and I think breaks out of a lot of what people thought of him for having gotten famous in 50 Shades of Grey. He's having a really good year for showing new sides of himself. So let's hear that conversation with Jamie Dornan. I mean, I was going to ask you, because I think a lot of people were planning to be in L.A. for these couple weeks with all these events going on, and now none of them are happening. So what's that been like for you? I mean, you're still in L.A., so clearly you're in town, but what was that shift like for you?
It's strange, isn't it? Because you, that's kind of, luckily for us, it's not the only reason. It's a reason we're here this early. I was meant to come out actually about a week earlier, and then my family followed out a few days later because my wife's a film composer, and she was recording a score right up until Friday there, so they were going to join me after, but all ended up coming later because things kept getting cancelled and getting postponed. But it's strange to fly all this way and to be doing a lot of Zooms and virtual press. I could be doing this at home, but my wife, is her next job is here in LA in February anyway, so we needed to get out here anyway for her job. So I think it'll all make sense. I do think in a few weeks we'll be in rooms together, hopefully again, and it'll be a bit more.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, a bit more normal. And, I think we are, I think in the States you're about 3 or 4 weeks behind where we are in the UK with all the problems. We reached our peak and we're out the other side, and hospitals are just about, dealing with it. And now everything's easing again. So I'm hoping that the same thing will be happening here in a few weeks. So
yeah. Well, and for this film in particular, like the power of the people in the room and people coming up to you. And I think you and Kenneth Branagh have had stories about, you know, everyone being feeling like it's their own personal story. Like you get a dose of that in-person interaction. And then going back to trying to connect with people over the movie on Zoom, it's now that you know what you're missing, it's so hard to go back.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of it's very hard to have any sort of real human connection with someone through a computer. It's difficult. And also, like, if someone's got a lot of nice things to say about your work, it's so much nicer when you can, there's a, you know, palpable feeling and energy coming off them that you can digest in person.
Yeah, totally.
And it works both ways. You know, everyone, it's just a better situation for everyone as long as we're safe. And, you know, so We'll get there. I think everyone's craving it, but you know, it's right to be taking every safety measure we can until we're through this thing.
Yeah. So I was going back and looking at some of the in-person press you did do before we all got stuck back behind our computers. And you had talked about how when you were on set, you could talk to Kenneth Branagh and kind of ask him, like, what would your father have done? What was this moment like? And it didn't feel like he was kind of prescribing to you what the character was, but it felt like guidance. And that feels so tricky to me. That's such a hard balance for him not to just be, you know, especially as an actor, like giving you line reading. So how did he strike that balance? How did it work out that you felt empowered with that information and not kind of trapped?
Because it was very much him feeling like he was telling me whatever information I was seeking from him to be like, use that how you will, absorb that in whatever way you need it to work for you. But as long as it's you as Jamie instinctually doing what you wanted to do anyway, then I'm happy. Because he was just right from the beginning of the sort of journey of Belfast, instilling this idea in me and all of us, really, that he wanted us to bring our own vibe to it. And and we should not be trying to be some carbon copy of an idea of who his parents were. And, you know, the reality was, of course, we're playing real people, but it is a version of them. And it's not like where you're playing a real person who's very famous and you can mimic them and copy their physicality and their movements and their tone of voice. That's not what we're dealing with, you know. So it was easier just to find a freedom to bring what we instinctually thought was right for these characters. And yeah, I think guidance is the right way of saying, like, you know, if Ken felt that it was becoming something that wasn't sort of cohesive with his idea of who his parents were, then he would bring us back. But he would never, I don't think he ever did that. You know, it was very supportive is what I'd say. It was just so supportive in what our choices were and our ideas were.
Was there a particular moment in the film or a scene where you found it especially helpful to get that feedback from him about what reality was about or what it was like to be in that specific world?
Yeah, probably when Katrina and I have the big fight.
The dish throwing fight?
Yeah, the dish throwing fight, yeah. Because, yeah, that's tricky. You know, this is you know, largely based on real events in Ken's life, and about 90% of it happened, and that is one of the ones that happened. So you're talking about a difficult situation for someone to talk about a moment that happened 50 years ago that was probably really distressing to see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you also want to get an understanding of how heightened it got, how violent it got, what the threat level was, how much that affected him seeing it as a 9-year-old boy. For the scenes after and what sort of climax it got to know then what the fallout was and what the response was after and how they were with each other after for those scenes was so important, you know. So trying to gauge all that stuff, again, like a lot of stuff in the movie, it was one shot. Mm-hmm. We're not coming in for two shots or close-ups or anything. It was all playing in one. So there's an excitement that comes with that of going, right, Balf, here we go. Let's get all this in here. Let's really have a real spring at this one. And luckily, Katrina and I were just always on the same page about what we felt was right. And luckily, even more luckily, on the same page as Ken.
Yeah. I'm curious how the three of you discussed the everlasting love scene, the kind of the big, you know, tentpole scene in the movie in some way, because it's heightened and it doesn't feel real, but it's not especially a fantasy sequence. And I think, you know, it cuts to Jude Hill, so you know it's through his eyes. But how real it is has been unclear to me the whole time. And I'm curious if you guys had decided for yourselves how realistic it was and if that was important in playing it.
Yeah, well, you see, I think it's you know, there's a lot happening there, right? There's a lot on the physicality of the day and the practicality of that day. Having all those different players in the room, you know, a lot of people who are one or two day players in the senior pivotal roles in the movie all being there, you know, it was everyone except Ciarán for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But having us all in that room was an amazing feeling. But we had a lot of work to do. There's apart from the sort of the actual, at that time hadn't recorded my vocal. So I'm lip syncing, which is trickier than people think it is probably. The dance moves, which are very tricky if you have two left feet like me. And so there, all the technical things you're having to think about, you know, which whether you want to or not, no matter how much work you've done, they are occupying space in your head.
Yeah.
You know, you are.
Because you got to hit your mark. You have to be where the camera needs you to be.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're aware that you want it to look a certain way. And for it to look a certain way, you have to plant that foot to spin her around. Like, you know, so you're thinking about it. But really at the core of all that is the emotional stuff that's going on. And the storytelling is massively crucial. The release of what's just gone on, just burying your father, and the release of that of then trying to sort of celebrate his life in that moment, but also where Ma and Pa are in their relationship at the time is massive, you know, that it's really fractured. They're sort of on the brink there, you know, so there's so much conveyance of that through the looks between Katrina and I, and basically trying to say, like, we are really up against it here and we are being tested, but guess what? I love you and it's okay. We're going to be fine. We're going to get through this. So they're big things to play and big emotions to play and portray. So yeah, it was a big balancing act of trying to get the combination of all that together. But I think it worked. And I love the look of that scene. I know I'm in a lot of those shots, so that sounds like a fairly narcissistic thing to say, but like, I think particularly the lighting of that scene, the way it was set up, as you say, it has this sort of heightened otherworldly quality to it. And Harris Ambulucas shot it beautifully, and the way it was all set up was just made us look probably better than we were.
Yeah. I mean, you feel like this wake, you know, with these people who don't have a ton of money, might not have like a 3-piece horn section playing on stage. But it sounds like what you're saying is like, it doesn't really matter how like real it is, because the emotion is what comes across so clearly. And that's real. And that was what mattered to you guys.
I'm saying that a lot of Irish people are musical. So
there might be a 3-piece horn section. Yeah. And
I think they all lived in this, you know, pretty much on the same street. So it would be a case of here, go and grab a puppet and join us. But yeah, it's what was the other part of that?
Sorry. Oh, just that the emotions were what mattered as being real more than
absolutely. And if you're not getting that, if you're not getting that across, you're screwed. You know, and that no matter how fun the release is in that moment, and how great a song that is, or how good people think it'll look, or whatever. If we haven't portrayed the emotive element of that scene, then it won't work.
Yeah. I was really struck rewatching it about how much the movies are threaded into this film itself. Like, there's the family goes to see the movies, but then the whole confrontation has the theme song from High Noon playing in the background. And I wonder, A, if you watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or High Noon or any of the others, or if you and Kenneth Branagh talked about John Wayne at all as a figure for either that confrontation scene or throughout, as how this boy is imagining his dad as this John Wayne-worthy figure. Was that part of the conversation?
Yeah, we did talk about that a bit. And again, it comes back to that sort of idealistic way of seeing, you know, his parents, like almost seeing them as like these matinee idols that were like heroic almost to him. You know, he had them on such a pedestal, and that's kind of the way he he saw John Wayne and saw, you know, him and his brother saw these actors in movies. And he sort of, in a way, is like, well, my parents like that. It's like that idea that, like, when you're a kid, like, I remember thinking my dad was like the strongest man in the world when I was a kid. Certainly wasn't, you know, but just that idea you have of your parents, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a good relationship with your parents and see them that way, and you have the, you give them this sort of heightened sense, you know, of superpower almost. And I think that is something that Ken, when he was a kid, got from the movies and applied to his own people in his life, including his parents. So I watched, you know, I've watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang a lot, you know, I really have in my life. It was a big player in our youth when I was a kid, and I've actually shown it to our two eldest kids.
Did it work? Does it hold up?
Yeah, you know, it does. It does. It's weird. Chitty Chitty
Bang Bang. It is a weird movie.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of really out there, and especially, you know, the old sort of mad uncle, or is he an uncle, or whatever, who did the inventor or whatever, and who has that strange like toilet thing. And when they go to that world and the child catcher, and it's really out there, you know.
Yeah.
Judi Dench had never seen it. She'd never seen.
That's fascinating. I guess she was not a kid when it came out, and was like the wrong generation for it.
Yeah, that's a good point. She wouldn't have been, but you know, she had kids. It's just like, it's one of those massive films that it's just so embedded, you'd think, in so many people's lives. But she said that she's actually she'd hardly seen any films, and because she went to see, when she was a kid, she went to see Bambi, and it's horrific what happens, you know, in that movie. And she saw Dumbo, where she's taken away from her mother.
Heartbreaking.
And I think, was it like Watership Down or something? There's one other one that was just like really harrowing movies that like put her off films. So like,
that's amazing.
On it, like, she hasn't seen any films. It's crazy.
Wow.
But
it's worked out okay for her, I guess.
She's done all right, yeah.
So did you watch High Noon too?
I didn't watch High Noon. I actually didn't realize High Noon was going to be used until, because we changed, we had that. There's also other movies in there. At one point, The Great Escape was in there. Mm-hmm. What else was there? There's a couple of other ones in there. We filmed sort of reactions to all of them.
Yeah.
And I'd seen that, and I'd watched that again when I knew that was going to be in. But High Noon, I haven't seen, and I actually still haven't seen High Noon.
Very good.
Which is crazy. I need to watch it.
Well, I'm interested because you're talking about the matinee idol thing that he's imagining his parents. So, like, did you have John Wayne, Robert Mitchum? Like, was there a particular actor who you thought of as influencing this kid version of who Pa was?
Well, not specifically. No, I didn't. We talked a lot about, I had this idea of remembering myself as a young child and who I looked up to and who I would have thought was really sort of otherworldly and beyond and like something that was sort of unattainable. And for me, growing up, it was people that were doing, who were like, anyone who's from Belfast or from the north of Ireland who was like doing well on like, in movies and stuff was just so otherworldly to me. Like the idea that you came from that place and could be in movies was so crazy to me. It kind of still is, to be honest. I would sort of apply, you know, Liam Neeson or something, you know, like this, the idea of like someone who's from, that's from where you're from, but has achieved great things. And I remember, like, you know, I was probably more in my teens when, early teens when Liam had really become a big star. He's obviously a huge star in almost a different realm now with what he's done in the last 15 years with his work. But, you know, never forgetting what that sense of that felt like and what you sort of pinned to that, and then making that applicable to how Buddy saw these actors and saw his own dad, but also how I saw my own dad and continued to see my own dad until my dad died last year. You know, it's I know what that is. I know what that sort of hero worshiping thing is of your own father.
Yeah.
So being able to apply that was something that was pretty cool.
Have you wrapped your head around the idea of your kids thinking that of you? I find that I have kids as well, and I totally understand worshiping your parents, and I cannot think of myself in that worshiped role. And I don't know if it's if this has helped you kind of wrap your head around that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think they're there yet. with the worship aspect of it, I don't maybe think they ever will be. They still just think, I mean, our five-year-old said to me, when someone asked her what she wanted to be when she grows up, and she said, when I grow up, I want to be silly like daddy. I was like, that's a pretty great compliment, and I kind of love it. I think, you know, they're getting a pretty strong sense. I mean, you know, my wife and I both work in the same industry, and they see it from both sides. They get to see what mummy does, which is a very cool part of it, and to score films, and she did the score for Film I'm In, so they had a great time going up to see how mummy was getting on, trying to enhance daddy's performance with a bit of a piano here and there or whatever it was. But yeah, it's been nice the last couple of years. I've done a couple of things where I think they've been able to watch, and they'd be able to see a bit of Belfast, I think, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
I think I think it'll be a while before they're really kind of thinking it's cool, and maybe they never will. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you feel strongly about what they know about what fame and attention means? Like, do you feel like that's something you have to really navigate for them in terms of what you do?
Yeah, a bit. You know, they're often like, you know, we've made a choice in their very early formative years to live out in the middle of nowhere. We live in the countryside. There's no paparazzi. We're not going to any parties or fancy dinners where we're getting our photograph taken. We're pretty much out of the limelight for the most part, and we like it that way. Probably harder here when we're in LA. They'll have, like, you know, I was with our five-year-old yesterday, and a girl came up and, like, wanted a chat and a photograph. And after, my daughter turned around and was like, do you know her?
Totally logical question. It makes perfect sense.
I don't know her. And she said, why does she want to talk to you? And I said, well, I don't know. Like, some people, you know, the daddy's an actor and I'm in movies and on TV sometimes. And some people, you know, are like the stuff I do, and they see me and recognize me and want to chat, you know, and it's nothing more than that. And my daughter was like, oh, that's nice. So they're basically saying that they like you.
Yeah.
Like, maybe, I guess it is kind of like that. No, so there's an innocence to it all, I guess, at this stage. And, you know, I'm very good about, you know, like yesterday she wanted a photograph. I was like, can you just make sure that my kids
are
in it? And I'll check it after to make sure that there's not like an ear of my 5-year-old or anything weird. So, I think it's an ever-evolving thing that as they get older and their understanding grows of different scenarios and situations, we'll have to sort of play it by ear. But, you know, we haven't had anything that's been too dramatic or anything yet, or anything that we've really had to sort of explain to them yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And as your career grows too, you know, and social media changes, like it's such a moving target that you get to figure out what a joy of parenting on top of everything else you have to figure out.
Well,
I think it's fascinating. So Katrina was on the cover of our awards issue, and she talked to my colleague Rebecca Ford about her start in modeling. And I think it's interesting the way you guys both talk about it as having grateful for the experience, but getting to a point where you're like, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to stand in front of a camera. But then you both became actors, which is standing in front of a camera. It's very different. But I'm just really interested in why that transition made sense to you, that you were tired of that version of being visible, but chose another way to be visible, but with maybe more expression. Like, why did that feel like the right transition?
One of them I never planned on doing and didn't want to do. And the other one I always probably, if I'm going to be honest, harbored some ambition to do. I'll let you guess which was which. So there was something of maybe a dissatisfaction with modeling, even though it was incredibly kind to me. But I was always a bit like, it's not the end game for me, and I don't want it to be. And with all the respect in the world, I didn't want to be doing it in my 30s and my 40s.
Well, it's so hard to. I mean, it's easier for men, but it's hard not to. Easy.
You know what? I actually remember one time, I was at the same agency the whole time, and I remember an agent said to me really early on when I was like, I'd probably been doing it a few years. I was probably 22, 23 or something. And my agent saying you've got a face that's you know, it'll probably be last you a long time, like the shape of your face or whatever means that, like, you because you get a lot of models who they're the right look for that moment or whatever,
because this
sort of very angular thing, or like really like insect thin, whatever it is, good in that moment. But if you were sort of considered more classically what they want or whatever, then you'd have more longevity. And someone, this sort of agent, was explaining to me that, like, the way my face was, you know, I could get to do it for a long time, you know, into my, like, you know, up to 50 and beyond. And I remember going, like, that is awful. Like, that's the last thing in the world that I want to be doing when I'm
like, it crystallizes the feeling in that one moment. Totally.
And I remember saying, I said this recently during an interview, I remember thinking, like, once I started acting more, like, I remember going, like, I can't wait to be an actor so it doesn't matter what I look like. You
know, when did the news break to you that it might still matter?
But I guess it sort of doesn't matter as much. Like, there's emphasis as a model to, like, just always be, I don't know, you know, let's put it this way. In acting, you're usually, what is being drawn out are people's flaws, are human flaws, what are broken elements. Whereas in modeling, it's all about, like, looking your best. And if you're worried about looking good as an actor, you're screwed. Like, that's not what this game's about, you know?
Yeah. Did you and Katrina ever cross paths? You guys were working around the same time.
No, and isn't that crazy? I mean, it is crazy. People from the same, you know, from the northern part of a tiny island, who were both pretty much at the same time. Doing stuff. I was in and out of New York so much, and Katrina, for the most part, was in New York. I remember hearing years ago, 18 years ago or something, that there's this model from Monaghan, and you should meet her, you guys would get on great. And I was like, there's no way there's a model from Monaghan.
It might have been easier. You might have been happier in the career if you'd met each other and been able to, to connect there.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, amazing. And then when we did finally meet, we met at TIFF a few years ago, briefly, through, we both different movies there or whatever. And I thought she was great. And then obviously know her, you know, incredibly well now, and love her. And we then subsequently worked out we knew so many of the same people.
Oh, yeah. You do the game where, you know, if you're from somewhere that small.
We spend the whole time like, how did we never meet? Like, what? But anyway, I'm glad the way it worked out.
Yeah, it was meant to happen the way that it did, right? That does it for this week's show. You can find us at vanityfair.com. You can find so many great stories from our Awards Insider issue, which is out now for awards voters and all going up online, including Rebecca's story and Katrina Balf, David's story about the documentaries that would like a Best Picture nomination, and looking back at Oscar's dismal track record of nominating gay actors. There's so much to choose from. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich, and David?
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca?
Becca M. Ford.
And Richard had to leave, but he is at Rylaw's. You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7118. I loved reading all your SAG reactions. Please keep all of it coming. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for what we hope to be saying when there is a proper red carpet at this year's Oscars goes to Richard Lawson and his sister.
Well, that's an outfit.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
From PRX.